The 100 Years' War, the Duguesclin period. The war breaks out again in 1377, and this is going to be a real problem because Edward III is going to die at approximately the same time the war breaks out. Now, in early March 1377, a few days after the dissolution of Parliament, the Council received its first inkling of the scale of French military plans for the summer when it discovered about the projected invasion of Wales. A report was received from Sir Thomas Felton, the seneschal of Gascony, that Sir John Minsterworth had been captured by a Gascon squire in the Var on his way to the Castilian court. He was brought back to Bordeaux and put on a ship bound for England. Minsterworth's papers told most of the story, and the rest was extracted from him under torture at the Tower of London. He was drawn and hanged, and his quarters distributed to the four corners of the realm to warn others of the perils of treason. Shortly after this, the French government negotiations with the Scots became known when Charles V decided to send one of his private secretaries, Pierre Bournisseau, to a secret mission to concert plans with the Scots. Unfortunately, his flamboyant manner and princely dinner plate betrayed him. He was stopped at the port of Dam by the officers of the Count of Flanders as he was about to board a ship for Edinburgh and accused of conducting the French king's business in Flanders without a ruler's consent. These reports intensified the English sense of vulnerability. The king's council was almost in continual session during the spring. The great men of the realm assembled roughly once a month to consider the state of negotiations with France and the conduct of the war which would follow on their collapse. The garrisons of Berwick and Lochmaben on the Scottish march were reinforced, although the French ministers abandoned their designs on Wales once the secret was out. The Welsh paladin Sir Diggory Say was sent to take charge of its defenses. 300 English troops were sent to the principality. All the major Welsh castles were repaired and filled with supplies. Their garrisons brought up the strength and equipped with artillery. At least in Wales, the English had the advantage of intelligence telling them where to expect an attack. The problem elsewhere was the immense length of the coast to be defended against an attack whose exact direction was impossible to predict. Coast guards were arrayed along the south and east coasts. Garrisons were put into the Isle of Wight and the ports of Devon and Cornwall, all of which had been targets of earlier French raiding campaigns. London, which had not been a target for 30 years, was put in a state of defense with watches kept on the walls and citizens formed in the units to resist attack. The whole fleet of the Northern Admiralty and most of the ships of the Western one were concentrated in the Thames. What the Duke of Lancaster needed above all was more time. For 5 months, from February to June 1377, the English tried to put off the coming of the conflict by breathing life into the moribund negotiations with France. The papal legates had passed much of January and February in Paris trying to persuade Charles V to extend the truce. The difficulty they discovered was the long lead time required for any major naval operation, which meant that Charles V was, for practical purposes, committed already. The Castilians were in the same position. Henry of Trastamara's fleet had been made ready for action at Seville. His ambassadors in Paris objected to any discussion with the English at all. From Westminster, the council sent a herald to Paris to listen out for news. They authorized the Earl of Salisbury, who had been permanently residing at Bruges since the previous autumn, to agree to a truce of 2 years. But when the conference at Bruges reopened in March, the French ambassadors had nothing to offer except for an invitation to meet again on the March of Calais and an extension of the truce for just 1 month until May the 1st. This was shortly thereafter extended to midsummer, June the 24th. Early in April, the ambassadors of both nations left Bruges for the last time. Now, there was a brief epilogue in Picardy. Papal legates installed themselves in May in the town of Montreuil in the Poitou and tried to open the conference there. Both governments sent solemn embassies to signify the importance that they attached to the occasion. The English sent the Chancellor and the Chamberlain, as well as the Earl of Salisbury, the Poitvin nobleman Guichard d'Anglais, and a host of clerks and officials, including the poet Chaucer. Charles V was represented by his own chancellor, Pierre d'Aiguermont, his principal chamberlain, Bureau de Reverie, and together the two bishops and two counts. Edward III's son-in-law, Augereau de Cossey, although formerly part of the French delegation, acted as a neutral intermediary as far as possible. The French chancellor's account of the proceedings more or less admits that the whole thing was a grandiose charade. As Orgamont wrote, and probably said, there's no reason for the French king to be particularly accommodating. In mid-May, while the diplomats were arguing at Montreux, Charles V traveled to Normandy to review the royal fleet of galleys and barges at the arsenal at Rouen. They moved downstream to their sea base at Harfleur at the beginning of June. They were joined there the next few days by the combined galley fleets of Castile and Portugal. The whole international force comprised 50 to 60 ships, including 36 galleys. Six of the cannon made for the siege of Saint-Sauveur, two armed with stones and four with lead shot, were hauled over from Contine to be mounted on the bows of the leading French vessels. A huge army of the sea was mustered at the beginning of June to fight from these ships no fewer than 3,500 crossbowmen, the largest concentration of bowmen which the French had ever assembled, several hundred men-at-arms, and at least 3,000 armed seamen. On the other side of the channel, more than 150 requisitioned merchant ships had been collected in the Thames off the Tower and at Rotherhithe. Nearly 4,000 men-at-arms and archers had been retained to fight on board these ships. The admirals were working towards an embarkation date in middle of July. Whether by accident or design, Charles V's ministers timed their diplomatic maneuvers absolutely perfectly. On June the 21st, 1377, just 3 days before the expiring of the truce, the papal legates at Montreux communicated Charles V's offer to the English ambassadors. The King of France, they say, would not restore any of the conquered provinces north of the Dordogne, apart from the strip of southern Saintonge along the right bank of the Garonne. The most he would do is buy out the English claims for 1,200,000 francs, that's 200,000 pounds, in cash. He was also willing to consider a marriage between the young Prince Richard and his daughter, Catherine, with the Angoumois as the bride's dowry. South of the Dordogne, he was prepared to cede all the provinces that had been held by the Black Prince before 1369, provided the English abandoned Calais. According to the French ambassador's evaluation, the territory which were offering comprised 16 or 17 walled cities and at least 4,000 fortresses. The proposal, of course, fell far short of English minimum demands. Edward's representatives had been instructed to draw out the negotiations as long as possible, and careful not to reject it, whatever their private thoughts. They said that they would give their answer on August the 15th at Bruges. They presumably asked for an extension of the truce, at least until then, but if so, it was refused. In the event, the slow progress of England's naval preparations made no difference to the outcome because the whole English plan of the campaign was thrown into disarray by the death of Edward III. The king's health had appeared to be mending recently. He had been rowed upriver for the annual festivities of the Order of the Garter at Windsor on St. George's Day. In what proved to be the last great pageant of his reign, Edward knighted his grandson, Richard of Bordeaux, together with his youngest son, Thomas of Woodstock, John Southery, his bastard by Alice Piers, and the heirs of the House of Lancaster, Oxford, Stafford, Salisbury, Percy, Mulberry, and Beaumont, a whole generation of young men destined to participate in the defeats and the divisions over the next two reigns. 2 months later, on June the 21st, 1377, the day that the last French offer was put forward, Edward III suffered a stroke at the royal manor of Sheen near Richmond. Paralyzed and speechless, he declined rapidly and died before the night was out. His death was as pathetic as the final years of his life. The malicious Thomas Walsingham reported that the knights and squires of his household slipped away to safeguard their fortunes in the new reign. Alice Piers is said to have fled from the house, taking the rings from his fingers as she went. The king died attended by a single priest. His death could not have come at a worse moment. It was out of the question for the leading members of the English political community to be away from the seat of government at such a time. The English naval expeditions, therefore, had to be cancelled. Troops mustered for it were stood down before they reached the port. Most of the ships were held in the Thames to await further orders. Powers of the English ambassadors at Calais automatically lapsed on the death of the king, who had appointed them. The Earl of Salisbury and his colleagues, unable to procrastinate, crossed the Channel to England on June the 23rd to find the country filled with lamentation and foreboding. The truce expired at dawn the following day. So, not a good deal for England. Well, But we'll have to see if the French can take advantage of it, because they have failed to do that in times before. Now, the sources for this: The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.